This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along. Sign up at Great. This week on Meat and Three, we're sipping on stories about how access, legislation, and circumstance affect what we drink.
I think now it's really changing that there's a growing excitement about drinks that are zero proof and alcoholic. So it just felt like kind of a very good timing.
This plant's been around for millions of years, and I just think that it's so special, so uniquely American and pre-American, that it just should have a very prominent place in our society, you know, for a lot of different reasons.
It is helpful to be able to sell one drink. It would be more helpful to be able to sell two or three at a time.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome writer and editor Julia Bainbridge. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Julia about non-alcoholic drinking culture, her latest book, Good Drinks, and we'll hear a Julia moment from a fellow Julia. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. Julia once said, "If you have not a good wine to use, it is far better to omit it, for a poor one can spoil a simple dish and utterly debase a noble one." Julia was not a teetotaler, as her books and television shows attest in their advocacy for drinking decent wine. We also covered her love of a good cocktail. The difficulty Julia had wasn't staying off the drink, but finding good domestic wine after returning home from years abroad. Now, what I believe Julia implies in that quote is, if you're going to drink something good, alcoholic or not. One can imagine her advising, why waste room on inferior drinks if you can instead have a second helping or dessert? At the Foundation, we continually look for ways to emphasize not only Julia's encouragement around cooking, but also the importance of eating and drinking well. Someone else named Julia is in full agreement that if you're going to drink, it should be something delicious, whether or not it's alcoholic. Joining us today is James Beard Award-nominated writer and creator of the Lonely Hour podcast, Julia Bainbridge. This Julia has worked as an editor at Condé Nast Traveler, Bon Appetit, Yahoo Food, and Atlanta Magazine, and has written for Food and Wine, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, most often, but not exclusively, about food and drink. The Lonely Hour podcast explores social disconnection and other forms of loneliness. Julia Bainbridge joins us today to talk about good drinks, alcohol-free recipes for when you're not drinking, for whatever reason, which also just happens to be the title of her new book. Julia is on a mission to normalize socializing without alcohol and to destigmatize loneliness. Welcome to the podcast, Julia.
Hi, Todd. Is all the Julia stuff going to get confusing?
I'm going to do my best. I might start calling you Julia B, okay. like in elementary school. Like Julia C and Julia B. I was saying to Amanda before this show that, you know, you do this job with, you just realize how common a name Julia is, and in both people and brands, and it's popular.
It is. Well, it's very good to be here. Thanks for having me. Although I can't say that I have, when in my drinking days, I can't say I followed the other Julias rule and always drank the most delicious wine. Sometimes it was just about the alcohol.
That does happen. And I'm sure Julia would admit to drinking Planck at various times. I think Two Buck Chuck was kind of after her heyday, but that is true. So tell us more about your mission to promote what you label good drinks.
Well, I removed alcohol from my life at a time when serendipitously alcohol-free cocktails were being taken more seriously. Mm-hmm. Something was happening. And again, it was just serendipitous that like there had never been a better time to be a non-drinker at the time I decided to be one. And bartenders were pushing against the boundaries that had previously limited mocktails to these syrup-laden juices. The imagination of the drinks world was moving beyond the Shirley Temple. And so I wanted to capitalize on that newfound acceptance and energy and to track the innovation and to celebrate these drinks. And so I feel very privileged to be able to explore something in my work that I have an interest in personally. And that's about it. Yeah.
Well, and obviously you have your personal reasons for choosing to remove alcohol or avoid it, but you kind of hit on that there's a time and a movement that seems to be expanding where more and more people are interested in non-alcoholic drinks and not drinking, as you say, for whatever reason. And what have you either, maybe you found it after the fact rather than intentionally dived into it, but what have you found is behind this kind of movement?
Well, yeah, I definitely think something, I came a little bit after the fact, or at least while something was taking shape, right? Because I was through the book and through my writing, I'm reflecting what was actually happening in the industry. And so the industry must have been responding to a consumer need or something else, right? I think the evolution of our drinking habits has been taking shape for a little while now. There's that big word wellness, We're more conscious of what we put in our bodies. We read the labels. We like to know where things come from. I think also under that umbrella comes our waking up to some of the more subtle dangers of alcohol. Now, I'm not like anti-alcohol, but I do think that, it would be good to pay attention to the ways in which, again, it might more subtly be affecting our lives. Someone who drinks, a drink a night might not meet the criteria for an alcohol use disorder, but that doesn't mean alcohol isn't a problem for them. Maybe they're experiencing some sleep impairment, maybe a little next day anxiety or weight gain, or some other consequence that may be meaningful to them and disrupting their lives, again, in smaller ways than the ones we associate with those struggling with alcohol use disorder, right? So, I think you've got a few things coming together. There's that piece of it. I do think little by little, the stigma around substance use disorder is losing strength. And then there's the pandemic. And obviously, I filed the manuscript for the book before this happened, but it has certainly affected our drinking.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a second, but I think you touched on something that is really interesting in that, particularly Western, at least not necessarily white dominated, but WASPy kind of based culture and others. But particularly in the West, centers around socializing and drinking being very common components, that if you're going to socialize, you would be expected to serve drinks or have a drink or go for drinks. And I think that's evolved a little. There's more, can we go for coffee, than I think there used to be. But it's pretty deeply embedded in at least pre-pandemic socialization. And do you think that's possibly where the demand for non-alcoholic but drinks that look like cocktails and wine came from?
I think that like gathering around a drink is really effective for social connection, right? Like you have a reason for coming together. You have something to delight you while you're, you know, chatting with your friend. But you are not distracted by, say, paintings on the wall of a museum. You know, I mean, there are other activities we can do together, right? We can go to museums, we can play soccer games, and that's all well and good. But I think, you know, when if you really want to deeply connect and have conversation, then you gather around food or drink face to face, right? Mm-hmm. And so, of course, then when it comes to the alcoholic drinks, there's the social lubrication factor in that, you know, alcohol is very effective. Stress reliever, you know, and sort of helps you unwind. But I don't think that the alcohol needs to be present for gathering around a drink to still be a great social activity.
I mean, did you find? Yeah, of course. And I was curious though, because there is that, and I think in many people it's a strongly held belief that, you know, you need the lubrication of alcohol where your inhibitions are loosened to relax. And I think that's stronger for some people than others. But in your work on this book and in writing about the subject, have you found that some of it is, it seems to be more psychological than physiological, or the physiological part is quite strong?
I think the physiological part is strong, but I think if you need this substance to facilitate socializing, perhaps you would do well to engage in some kind of anxiety reducing exercises or be in therapy.
Fair point, right? So I think you're saying, yes, most people physiologically get lubricated, but it is a certain group of people who may find it difficult to socialize at all without that lubrication.
Yes.
Okay.
And for those who can manage alcohol, like, that lubrication is great. Enjoy it, right? And by manage, I mean for those who can consistently enjoy alcohol and all it gives us in terms of flavor and the mood altering effect that we're talking about. If you can do that without abusing it, then, you know, I'm all for it.
No, and I think you put that across quite effectively in what you said and what you write about. But I also think it stands to reason, too, that they're sort of like not a level playing field, even if you are drinking alcohol, because just the way your body metabolizes substances, in particular alcohol, and your size relative to your peers matter. So it also affects, like, if people of varying sizes and backgrounds get together, the quantity consumed is not consistent, really.
Yeah.
I suppose that could apply to sugar too, but I think to a lesser degree.
Yeah. So I guess my hope is that it becomes about the drinks and not the alcohol, right? That, like, drinks are still a great thing around which to socialize. What is contained in that glass, in terms of whether or not it has a drug in it, is less important.
Well, and I think you touched upon in your example of, oh, you can go to a museum, but there is something special that I think gets very tied to alcohol, but isn't the only part. If you think about bar and pub and various nightclub atmospheres, the fact that they're generally turned inward and dim and decorated in a certain way, they all facilitate a focus on who you're with or who you're trying to meet in a way that is culturally, societally unique.
Yeah, and just it's set up, and, you know, you're sitting on two sides of a table. You're looking into, you know, at one another's faces, as opposed to you're both watching a movie, you know, and looking at a screen, or doing any of the other activities we mentioned. Like, it's conducive to connection and good conversation.
So as we're having a good conversation, we started to talk about the pandemic, because I think it certainly has had both an impact and made people think quite a lot about some of these social habits, both the ones they miss and the ones that they might struggle with. And, you know, I thought it was interesting to ask you, because you started the Lonely Hour podcast well before the pandemic, and then I know you've done some since, but I was curious about your observations about the pandemic's impact, both on alone time and our drinking habits.
Well, we certainly all have a lot of alone time. Well, actually, I don't know. That's not true. I've never been happier to be childless, and I don't envy those of my friends who can't find any alone time because they are always with, you know, their partners and or children. So I don't know. There's no one sort of thing to say about it. But, you know, in terms of our drinking habits, you know, many of us heard about the rise in alcohol sales last March and April. I think the alcohol delivery service Drizly reported a 439% increase in orders, which makes sense. We were at home, so spending more money on drinks this way, direct to consumer, rather than, you know, at bars and restaurants. And also, as we said before, alcohol is, you know, it is an effective, we talked about social lubricant, but also emotional pain reliever, you know, and a lot of us turned to it to soothe our stress. You know, drinking works. It does help take away some of that stress and help you relax while you're drinking, but not the day after, right? So I think, like, since then, you know, I've seen a number of things happening. Some people have changed that behavior, and kind of after, you know, those are the people for whom cocktail hour had returned, right? They settled into a new style of drinking. This was a way to punctuate the day when you don't have a workplace to leave. And, you know, now you're in your personal time in home or at a third space like bar or restaurant. Like, the way that you separate the workday from, you know, me time is the drink, right? So that return, some people found themselves drinking more than ever before, right? So, and then after a while of that, there were negative consequences. So now, you know, they've stopped, but they want to keep that ritual. You know, they've removed the alcohol, but they still want to have a drink because that's still the way to break up the day. And those are the people, you know, as well as, you know, the alcohol-free set who is always, you know, sober, if you will, who are driving the sales of these alcohol-free products. And many of them have come onto the market during this time. One of my favorites, it's an aperitif called Ghia. Not for nothing, side note, was named best new drink of the year in Esquire. I think that says something about a shifting culture, right? For them, dry January, yes, was huge and bigger than December, which was bigger than November. The founder, Melanie Mazarin, a French woman, told me. But she expected sales to drop after the first week or two of the month when resolutions kind of tend to be renegotiated. But they were seeing a strong and sustained sales through the end of January. And similarly, for Curious Elixirs, which is a bottled non-alcoholic cocktail brand, January saw more than double the sales of other months, but 2021 seems to be a tipping point, like sales quadrupled. And while they've seen sales dip towards the end of the month, meaning January, in years past, they accelerated at the end of January, signaling that this is becoming like a lasting lifestyle for many, perhaps, you know? So I think that perhaps what I'm saying is there was a lot of heavy drinking, and a set of that population is changing that behavior. Of course, there was a lot of heavy drinking, and these are people who are going to be dealing with the consequences, unfortunately, right? Like, I think there are many people who, you know, struggle with alcohol use disorder who have slipped back into their addictions. At the same time, there are lots of people who have been using this time as an opportunity to explore their relationships with alcohol. You know, people who thought maybe they kind of always might have had a problem. And this is a great time to explore it because there are no awkward social encounters or business meetings, you know, no unwanted questions. So I think, I don't know, I'm all over the place a little bit, but it's a
lot. No, I think you made your point. And I think actually in what you just said, yeah, it is interesting for anyone who could excuse certain habits or behaviors because, oh, well, I'm doing this because I need to or I have to for work or whatever. The pandemic removed a lot of those things, and you really had yourself or your immediate family or who you live with to look in the mirror without those kind of constraints. And then maybe on the more positive side, I was thinking about when you were talking about people, for whatever reason, the pandemic, Dry January, discovering non-alcoholic drinks or cocktails that were special or unique or made for grown-ups. And also one thing we haven't touched about is the sort of movement away from old-fashioned soda because of its content and how it's made, right, that people are doing that. But I was thinking it was sort of like, it's like Mad Men and that series and how it started. And it's like, oh, it's so beautiful. And what a wonderful time. And then it all sort of disintegrates into hell. And it's sort of like Mad Men with all the benefit and not the end result. All right. Well, we'll be right back to talk with Julia Bainbridge about her latest book, Good Drinks, Alcohol-Free Recipes for When You're Not Drinking for Whatever Reason. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along, a three-day hosted virtual garden festival connecting you with the influencers, tastemakers, and cutting-edge content of today's gardening world. The Great Grow Along will feature 40-plus sessions on topics ranging from houseplants to DIY landscaping. New plant parents and first-time gardeners will gain practical advice and creative inspiration from celebrated garden experts and industry leaders. Costing $29.95, tickets allow attendees to mix and match a wide range of sessions, or choose to follow one of the conference's six tracks, which include edible gardening, urban gardening, pollinators and plants, DIY landscaping, houseplants, and dig deeper. The Great Grow Along will take place March 19th through 21st, 2021. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
Welcome back. We're about to make you very thirsty. We're getting into the mouth-watering details. We're talking to Julia Bainbridge about her new cookbook, Good Drinks, Alcohol-Free Recipes for When You're Not Drinking for Whatever Reason. So one of the things, Julia, I was struck with in the book is you write that the best drinks are memorable. So I wanted to ask you, you did a lot of research and you narrowed it down to kind of a top 50 or so recipes. And so for the ones you picked, what made them so memorable to you?
That is a good question. First of all, I want to thank you for calling this a cookbook and not just a drinks book, because I think that's a point I try to impress upon readers, is that, like, really to make these drinks, you're going to have to roll your sleeves up and cooking. I mean, again, the manuscript for this book was filed before a lot of these new products that you can lean on to make really complex, delicious alcohol-free drinks came onto the market. So you can, you know, open a bottle of Ghia, which I mentioned before, mix that with a bit of tonic or soda water, and call it a day, right? But before, I think I filed the manuscript when really Seed Lip was the only alcohol-free spirit that was accessible. And so a lot of these bartenders were building these things from scratch. And if you want to get bitterness, you might have to source some gentian root. If you want to get some complexity, you might have to get out your stock pot and steep a bunch of different teas and peels and things. So, you know, I think I'm someone who likes that kind of tinkering. And so to me, it's really interesting. But in terms of what ones were memorable or you know, why did these drinks make the cut? Because I really did cast a wide net. I got in my car. I have such nostalgia for that trip now because I was just moving about so freely and basically lived, you know, in my car, who is no longer with us, Greta. Aww. I drove her into the ground. my Subaru Impreza. She was a 2006 model, though. So, you know, she was on her last legs anyway, I think. But
she did you proud.
She did me proud. And she's bits of her are now in New Jersey somewhere. Her parts have been harvested to become other things, I think. But
she's an organ donor to boot.
Yes. But, you know, I drove across the country. I, you know, lived this way for months to really get a sense of what was going on here. In a way, I feel like this book is a snapshot of approaches to alcohol-free, you know, cocktail building at the time. And the ones I chose, you know, one, it had to be a level up from a fizzy lemonade. It had to do the work of fighting against the bad reputation this category has of the drinks being too sweet. And if sweetness was the prominent taste, then there had to be something going on in the recipe that made that acceptable. And it had to surprise me. And this one's a little bit harder to explain without sort of going through every drink in the book. But, you know, the book isn't necessarily for bartenders. I think a lot of drinkers, for example, don't salt their cocktails at home. You know, I think that there are some drinks in here that serve to educate us. And then there are ones that just surprise us. I mean, there's miso in one of these drinks, for example.
Well, would it help to get specific? Because I wanted to ask you to just kind of call out, particularly the book is organized in a specific way, particularly in terms of sort of the occasion. And one of you feature just like everyday weeknight drinks, and then you have party recipes and going out ones. So what, maybe just start with like, what are a couple of your favorites that, you know, are less time intensive and maybe more likely to have ingredients on hand that you would whip up on a weeknight?
Yeah. I mean, thanks for pointing that out in terms of the breakdown of the book. I think before I answer your question, you know, it's the reasons you reach for an alcohol-free drink are just as diverse as the reasons you reach for an alcoholic drink, right? And should be given the same attention. So that's why I broke the book down into the chapters that I did, splitting it into times of day. Sometimes you drink to relax, to connect, to let loose, to toast the end of the day. And these drinks all satisfy those diverse needs. But if I'm, let's see, like a weeknight easy drink.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking if you're just drinking, you know, you want a cocktail for yourself. You were talking about the ritual many people have found in the pandemic as a way to break the day or signal like, okay, I'm done working. I'm drawing a line in the sand, but I'm not entertaining. I'm not expecting to that. And I'm also tired. So I don't feel like using the blender.
So my go-to, and this may not be, well, actually, maybe listeners of this particular show would have this ingredient on hand. My favorite drink in the book, which is, and it's on the cover for that reason, is the Verjus Spritz. And I love it because it's three ingredients, that none of which you make yourself. They are all bottled, and you open those bottles and pour them into a wine glass in equal parts and add some ice, and you're done. So it's white Verjus, which your listeners may have used to finish dishes or in salad dressings, but I'd urge you to move your Verjus to the bar and drink it because it has that kind of soft acidity to it that's so elegant. So you balance that out with equal parts tonic water and soda water. Tonic water brings you a little sweetness and bitterness, and then the soda water's there to kind of let it all breathe a little bit and prevent you from getting too sweet. I think if you just had equal parts Verjus and tonic water, you might get into that territory. So that with, you know, salty Utz potato chips and olives at 6 p.m., great.
And it kind of sounds like, would you say it's somewhere in the range of just comparing it to what the alcohol equivalent would be, is like a champagne cocktail or a white wine spritzer sort of
feel? I'd say, yeah, like white wine spritzer is a good, yeah, I would say that.
Very
like
nice.
Like a great way to, something to drink maybe while you're making dinner, you know, to sort of get the appetite going.
It also sounds like it'd be perfect if you, we talked about at the top of the show about well-being, part of the movement toward non-alcoholic, and people, particularly listeners of the show who might be home cooks, catering to, you know, about 20 million different dietary needs at a summer lunch party. If you're having vegans and vegetarians or a lot of people who are quite health conscious, serving that as your kind of summer lunch but party drink could be a fun thing.
Yeah. And then one way I like to level it up, and this does involve sugar, so maybe this is less for the people who are into wellness with a capital W, is the saffron charbat. So it has the same ingredients, but you just make this saffron infused syrup. So that's it's saffrony and a little bit of orange flower water in there. So you get that floral note. And you mix that in with the white Verjus and some soda water and a lemon twist. And so it's just a kind of different version of the Verjus spritz, but you get that. I love saffron. I love saffron in savory dishes. I love it in sweet dishes, you know, and I think, yeah, this is another go-to. And it adds in, makes the color a little bit more, gives it some depth. You know, it's really like a golden looking drink.
And we should talk about syrups for a second, because on the one hand, it's kind of like, oh, you have to make that. But they're really easy to make. And once you make them, you can make a batch and it go. And like once you've, it's just level, to me, speaking of things that level things up, they just kind of enhance everything. And particularly if you make them at home, then you're not adding whatever stabilizers or chemicals that are used to make them shelf stable. So do you have anything to say about syrups? Because they're a big part of a lot of the recipes, right?
Yeah, I totally agree with what you say, that they're fairly easy to make. There are a bunch of different methods for making them. You can heat them up. You can just put the ingredients in a, you know, blender and it comes together. Google it and you will find many methods for making infused simple syrups. But usually, yes, they're just equal parts sugar and water and then whatever element you're using to flavor it. And they're key to alcohol-free drinks because while alcohol is such an effective flavor extractor, you don't have that when it comes to these drinks. And so the syrup is a great way to carry flavor that you wouldn't be able to get into the drink through, you know, just citrus juices or whatever else. So you can bring in an herbal element. You can make a coffee syrup. You can, you name it. So yes, you make it once. It stays good in the fridge for, I don't know, 2, but I've pushed it sometimes to 3 weeks. And you can make a big batch.
Now, I can't remember if there are any recipes for this, but one of my go-to non-alcoholic, but feel like a grown-up at the end of the day, I do have kids during a pandemic, so I know what you're talking about, before, is elderflower, an elderflower cordial. And you mix that with, you know, you put it over ice with sparkling water, club soda, and a twist, and it's delicious. Did you?
I do not have that in there, but so how do you make your elderflower cordial?
I buy it. But you can make it. Elderflower cordial, I think, is harder to make because you have to somehow – I've read how it's made because I was curious. But it's more complex in that I think you have to steep elderflower for – like you have to do something to the natural elderflower a lot more than like mint or something like that.
I see. Which, you know, again, when you say complex, you just mentioned steeping. It's – really not a complex technique. Like finding the elderflower, yes, may take some doing, but once you have it, you're just letting it sit in warm water, essentially.
Yeah, no. Well, no, you might be right. That's right. It's like, I think I read a whole thing about where you find it and it's kind of like chamomile. But yes, I think that's my highly recommended and particularly the most simple. But let's move from the simple to the complicated, or maybe not. But I wanted to ask you, because you have great recipes also for like, if you're hosting a party and you want to go out non-alcoholic or offer guests a non-alcoholic option, you have a whole set of drinks for that. And I was curious which ones you like, particularly if maybe you're going to do this for the first time and you haven't been to bartending school. What do you have one recipe that you're like, oh, maybe you should start with this one because it's fun and it might wow your guests, but isn't going to overtax you in the getting started?
Well, it depends on the situation and what you're eating. But I would say if we're talking about, let's see, when are we really going to be able to move about more freely? Let's knock on wood, hope by the summer we can gather. So poolside in the summer.
Okay, good.
I think you can capitalize on all of the great non-alcoholic beers there are now and make a radler, a grapefruit radler. So that would just require you to get non-alcoholic beer, which by the way, because it's alcohol-free, you can get it shipped to you pretty easily. So it's the non-alcoholic beer, a bit of simple syrup, and otherwise freshly squeezed juices. So some grapefruit juice, a little lemon juice. You can mix a little soda water in there to take some of the edge off. But really you're just, yeah, you combine the juices, the simple syrup, soda water in a glass and top it with beer and that's it. I'm sure you could make that a pitcher drink pretty easily if you were, filling your guests' glasses quickly and not letting it sit there while the fizz goes out.
And so it kind of ends up like a Pimm's without alcohol in it a little bit?
Kind of. I do have a sort of alcohol-free PIMS that's a little bit more involved, but it's just a Radler. You know, I mean, you have Radlers, you know, with alcoholic beer. It's just an alcohol-free version of that.
I've never had that, so I was just trying to imagine it. But that, yeah. And so what is the is that a drink that's trying to kind of be an alcohol-free version of a drink people know, or is it just a certain flavor profile that the non-alcoholic beer, because it's brewed, adds to the drink?
I think, let's see, for this particular recipe developer, probably he was just making an alcohol-free version of something you know, but he was capitalizing on the fact that there are all these delicious alcohol-free beers now. Mm. And I think it's just such a great summer drink because you don't have a whole, you know, beer which can feel kind of heavy. It's really brightened up with these juices, kind of a beer lemonade, if you will. It's just, you know, a beautiful drink that's not fully lemonade. You're going to get a little bitterness, and depending on what kind of beer you go for, if, you know, kind of breadiness, toastiness, that just adds another layer of complexity, kind of makes it adult.
Yes. And that seems to be a common characteristic, that it's the complexities of the flavors and the flavor profile that makes a lot of these drinks stand out and makes them adult and also makes them worthwhile. Like we talked about at the top of the show, obviously people, I think, are still learning that drinks like food convey calories. So if you're going to take in the calories, you might, as in my view, make it worthwhile. But is it that a lot of what makes these drinks special and worth drinking is they have complexity to the flavor and the taste profile?
Absolutely. I mean, you do have, this book was meant to be a compendium and kind of show you a big range. So it's hard to say kind of one thing about this collection. But yes, I think one of the reasons why these drinks, you know, stayed with me as I drove around thinking what deserves to, you know, take up a page in this book was that they're the kinds of things that, I mean, I don't know, some of them, like the Grapefruit Rattler, sure, that's a little bit more complex than just a lemonade because it has the beer in there. But certainly that's less complex than some of the others. And I'd say the complexity that comes from something like some of the level 4 recipes is part of what makes it adult, because it slows us down. I think if we were also talking about, you know, connection, and I think part of feeling included and connected to your friends is if you're drinking sort of in pace with them. And, you know, before a lot of these drinks had been developed that required you to slow down, sip them slowly, think about, you know, try to pick apart the flavors, think about what you're drinking. I think that's part of what makes them adult, right? You would have these things that were sweet and often, you know, fizzy. It's just in a Collins glass, and you kind of crush it while your friends who are slowly sipping their whiskey as it unfolds, you know, are still on their first round. And so I think there's something to that too, that the complexity helps you all stay with one another, if you will.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, we've teased people enough about these really complex drinks, so I think we have to talk. You have to pick one for us that demonstrates some of the multi-step processes that then end you up with a pretty special concoction.
Yes, that's. I have the book right here, and I'm flipping through it. I mean, some, I would say, here's one that is meant to kind of mimic a wine, and it's called the Upbeat. It comes from Brandon Tepper from Angler in San Francisco. And you really get these robust tannins in the drink because you have a mixture. You have tea. You know, tea is such an important ingredient to building these drinks. So you have oolong tea and beet juice, and a little bit of pomegranate juice. And those three things really do. It's just robust, and it gives you, without using a syrup, a nice weighty mouthfeel, which is, I think, another thing that people comment about missing in alcohol-free drinks, that they feel thin. And this, because of the tea and these juices, especially the beet juice, really is hefty in a good way, if you will.
And you do have some drinks, because I feel like we have to cover one that kind of move into grasshopper territory where they're blended and then have a foam on them. And you talk about that. Can you give us one of the example of one of the ones that is very memorable for you, and from when you first had it to putting it into the book?
Let's see. Well, I don't know if this satisfies the foam on top. There are some. I mean, I keep going back to the Billows and Thieves, which is a mixture of coffee and grapefruit juice and like a cardamom-y infused syrup. And that the sort of bitterness on bitterness of the grapefruit juice and cold brew really works. And you shake the heck out of it and you get this beautiful foam on top in a coupe. But one that is definitely complex that I have been impressed with even one person making from the book. But certainly, you know, the first really like sophisticated non-alcoholic drink that stayed on my mind for you know, weeks, months, and I guess apparently years now, is the champagne from Aterra in New York. And, you know, that is made from you make a tea or a tisane from white pine needles. So you have that, and you mix in some acids, you know, powdered acids, tartaric, lactic, and malic acids, which give you a kind of champagne-y quality. So you make this tea, you sweeten it a little bit with sugar and honey, you add in these acids, you carbonate it, and you do really get this brightly acidic, effervescent, piney drink. That and it may seem intimidating. Really, the hard part is gathering the ingredients, and after that, it's just steeping and stirring. That really impressed me. That was the thing that blew my mind when I tasted it. Also, because at Aterra, they, bottle it and present it to you in the restaurant, and it has a label on it. And I had never been treated this way as a non-drinker before that. I think I first had that drink when I was still drinking, actually, but still ordered it and was very impressed.
No, that is true. There's something about the ritual of, there's a big difference between being granted a special bottle with an upscale non-alcoholic drink than versus just having a Shirley Temple slapped on the table where it's like kind of sticky on the glass and an afterthought. And that part of the elevation is the presentation, whether it's alcoholic or not, I think.
Absolutely. And that's part of what led to my just being kind of moved by this movement, if you will, is that like, you know, luckily I'm somebody who I had removed alcohol from my life, but I was out at bars and restaurants with friends. Luckily I'm someone who, you know, was not like triggered by being in those environments. And I was looking for things to drink that, you know, weren't soda and weren't water. And it was impossible not to notice that these drinks were taking up more real estate on menus and were being given names, just like the, you know, regular quote unquote cocktails were being given names. You know, they were really treated with care, and that was a change. And I think that in that way, the industry has really had, you know, power to shift a paradigm. I spoke to someone who runs a visual communications agency for a story about this very thing, you know, menu design specifically. And she spoke to the influence that bars can have. And, you know, she said a menu can be incredibly psychological. You know, how important do you feel considering what you're associating with on the menu? If you're associating with the thing that's discarded and not celebrated, then that's how you feel, right? And often before this sort of movement started taking shape, anybody who didn't drink and was going to a restaurant knows where to go to find the options for them. You turn the menu over and look at the bottom, you know?
Yeah, it's like the back far corner over on the right, but in very small type.
Yeah, so it's really, it's exciting that, you know, they've bubbled more to the surface. That goes with the presentation, just as you said. I remember I was in Los Angeles at this point during research and staying with a friend, Alex Shapiro. I'll give her a shout out here. She's been a dear friend of mine since we were 5 years old. And I had a bottle of Seedlip with me. Her mother, her parents, who I know very well, of course, because we grew up together, were visiting her at the time. And I put this bottle of Seedlip on the table. Her mother, who has stopped drinking later in life, the way her eyes lit up when she saw this bottle, which For those who haven't seen it, is just beautiful packaging, beautiful shape. You know, absolutely looks like it should take up real estate on the bar cart. Looks very at home next to any other spirit, you know. And she said, I'm always out with my girlfriends and they order wine and then I get this stripy straw and some pink fizzy drink. And oh my gosh, what is this thing? And she hadn't tasted it yet, but it was strictly the visuals that just delighted her. She was so excited to have something that looked chic and alcohol-free.
That's so nice. All right, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, Julia is going to share her own Julia moment. Get in touch. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or better yet, tweet us @JuliaChildJCF and let us know what you think about today's show or share your ideas for future guests. For more drinking commentary from Julia Child, a new book of her quotes, People Who Love to Eat Are Always the Best People, and Other Wisdom, is out now in hardcover and ebook from Knopf. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. All right, Julia, what's your Julia moment?
It's more than a moment, but, and Todd, you need to correct me on the history if I'm wrong about this.
Okay,
but
I will.
Based on my research or my knowledge of Julia Child, you know, things popped off, if you will, for her sort of later in life or at middle age.
Correct, yeah.
Yes, Mastering the Art of French Cooking was published when she was 49, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a great foil to the stress we all feel when we see the annual Forbes 30 Under 30 list.
Yes, those are, you know, so mean.
We have this feeling that we need to be successful now, or should have been when we were young, and that if you're not, then you're doomed. And I think that Julia's career and life, wasn't she married at 34?
Well, I can't remember exactly how old she was, but she was, would have been considered a spinster in her day and very
exactly
worrisome.
Right. Yeah, 34, not old by any means, but I imagine.
For when she was living.
Late. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm 38 and unmarried, and I think I've just found the love of my life. We'll see. And also I'm sort of after a career of being kind of a generalist in my food writing came to this beat of alcohol-free drinks somewhat later into it. In fact, starting grad school I'll continue writing about this, but I'm beginning grad school in the fall to do something completely different and starting sort of a whole another career that may dovetail nicely into the loneliness stuff that you mentioned at the top of the episode. So I'm inspired by Julia taking her time to come to her true passions and success.
Oh, that's great. And I think that is one of the symbolic things that so many people appreciate about Julia and what she accomplished and what she represents, that it's never too late and that there's not one age when you can discover your passion. And if it is later than you would have liked or other people expected, it doesn't matter. It's still worthwhile. And I thank you for selecting that inspiration from Julia.
Yeah, there's one other in case too many people have used that as their Julia moment.
There are no limits. There are no limits.
I think that also the time she took with the projects themselves, I think I read somewhere she spent as many as 19 hours preparing for each half hour segment of one of her shows, and that it took 10 years of devoting herself to writing and testing and rewriting for the book Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And I think also in this era when we're publishing so much and so fast, I'm comforted by
Julia is having taken her time, because that's what I require too, to do good work. And I constantly feel like my peers are able to be excellent and do it, you know, quickly and often. And I'm not quite that way. I need to take more time, publish things more slowly. And Julia is the patron saint of that for me.
That's true. I think Julia was very thorough. And I think for you, Julia, I think for those who check out your book, you'll see that. It's a very sensitively and deeply crafted work with, as we've talked about, many layers of complexity, which I really appreciated. And I know Julia would have. And I think that that is much to be admired and sometimes, but not always underappreciated. And I kind of hope we're moving and continuing to move in an age where that in many facets of living, as we become less materialistic and more concerned with learning and experiences, is valued.
I agree with you. That may be one of the silver linings of the pandemic, that for those of us who are privileged to be at home and safe, we've also been forced to slow down. And I have realized that I function much better with a less full social calendar. I certainly miss my friends, but I think that this is teaching me about some of the ways in which I want to live when we emerge from this.
Well, that's nice. And I think Julia would have said it too. Balance. Balances. There was a bit of a mania, particularly amongst people interested in food and drink, that you had to just be out all the time,
right?
You know, photographing your food. Well, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your knowledge and inspiration of good drinks.
Thank you, Todd.
Our pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Again, the book is Good Drinks, Alcohol-Free Recipes for When You're Not Drinking for Whatever Reason by Julia Bainbridge, with mouthwatering photographs by Alex Lau. It's out now from 10 Speed Press. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. You can check out juliabainbridge.com for links to more of her work. It's at Julia Bainbridge on Twitter and Instagram. Keep up with the Foundation and about new podcast episodes by following at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. We'll soon post the calendar of events for this year's Santa Barbara Culinary Experience, which you won't want to miss. Even if you can't get to Santa Barbara, you'll still be able to participate. And if you want to follow along on Instagram at SB Culinary Experience, you'll have all the latest news as soon as it's out. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks to my co-producer of the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Amanda Wang. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.